This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. We are enjoying the beautiful spring weather and the spring in our step that we have for having broken 300,000 downloads. It's a wonderful achievement and we are growing an impressive global footprint. So firstly, let me thank you all so much for all of your heavy duty listening that you're doing and that you continue to do. Don't forget to not only listen to our latest releases as they happily land in your podcast apps, but do please go back into our back catalogue and check out all of the fabulous stuff we've recorded in the 2 short years since we've begun. If you're interested in naval history, let me recommend our mini-series on great sea fights. If you're interested in famous vessels, let me recommend our mini-series on iconic ships. If you're interested in a global perception of maritime history, then listen to our episodes on maritime Africa, maritime Wales, maritime Australia, and know that we've got many more coming your way, maritime China, maritime Sweden, among many others. To celebrate our international outreach today, I thought I'd line up something special. So we are beaming our way across the world to New Zealand to find out about one of the most interesting historic vessels I've ever come across. The Edwin Fox, now living out her retirement at the wonderful port of Picton in the very north of the South Island of New Zealand. What a ship! Built in India to British specifications, the Edwin Fox is not only one of the world's oldest surviving merchant sailing ships, she's also the only surviving ship that transported convicts to Australia. She also carried settlers to both Australia and New Zealand. She carried troops in the Crimean War. She carried indentured servants to the Caribbean from China. To find out more, I spoke with Heather Fryer, a volunteer researcher for the Edwin Fox Maritime Museum. Now, Heather has one of the best accents I've ever heard. It's half Yorkshire, half New Zealand. She's lived in New Zealand for many years, but her vocal cords have some form of permanent jet lag. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to her as much as I enjoy talking with her. Here is a perfect example of the fuel that keeps our global maritime heritage alive. The deeply knowledgeable, the hardworking, but above all, the exemplar of a woman generous with her time and talents for the benefit of historical knowledge. Here is the fabulous Heather. Heather, thank you very much indeed for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure.
The more I find out about this ship, the more interested I am in her. She sounds absolutely fantastic. Tell us a bit about the Edwin Fox and how she began her life.
Well, she was built in the shipyards of Thomas Reeves. He had a shipyard on the banks of the Hooghly River in Calcutta, or Calcutta as it's known now. It was built in 1853. It took a remarkable 9 months, which we think is a very short period of time. It's built mainly of teak and sole. And I think they kind of estimated about 1,000 teak trees to actually complete the ship. So that's quite an amazing amount of trees. That's one of the reasons we can't restore it, because we can't get the trees anymore. So at launch, it was around 836 tons and 159-ish feet long. So not a big ship and not a pretty ship, just built for as a workhorse.
A classic example of a workhorse as well, right? Those teak trees are interesting because being made of Indian hardwood makes her almost impervious to rot, which is probably one of the great advantages you have that she's still here.
It is, absolutely, absolutely. So she left the shipyard heading for London. As soon as she got to London, very strangely, she was taken to the docks, dry docks, stripped down, and a lot of extra metal knees adding for strengthening and a few other modifications. And that was to achieve the A1 Lloyd standard that she needed for trading. So it's a bit strange, a brand new ship, and she goes straight into dry dock and get repaired.
I wonder whether that was because they changed the rules during her construction or whether she was just built for one thing and then was required to do another.
Not sure. We're not aware. Not sure.
Well, we'll try and find that out. I think that's an interesting interesting crossover between shipbuilding and the classification and the rules and regulations. So she was changed a little in London. Was she then good to go to start her career?
Basically. I mean, she started as a fully rigged ship and she did get changed later on in her life to a bark. But yes, she started life as a fully rigged ship. Named after Edwin Fox. It's only recently he's been discovered who he was. There's a remarkable...
I've never heard of him. Who is he?
Well, he's Edwin Goodhue Fox. So he's a London businessman, auctioneer, insurance broker. He was on the board of many businesses and seemed to have worldwide interests. And we're not quite sure the connection between Reeves and Fox as to why the ship was named after him. So that needs a little bit more research as well.
I should call out to any of our listeners. If anyone's interested in doing some research, do please get in touch with either myself or Heather, and we can put some work your way.
All volunteers are welcome. So I guess after that, the next kind of interesting point was as soon as she got to London, her builder, Reeves, he was there also shortly after, and he got persuaded to sell his interest in the ship to Sir George Hopkinson. But Sir George never actually paid Reeves, and that's where the ship went into auction later on and joined part of Duncan Dunbar's fleet.
Fascinating stuff. And do we know much about her early career, what she got up to?
She had quite an interesting career. It nearly ended before it started, because on her maiden voyage she actually was in Table Bay, South Africa, just getting rid of her cargo of rice and retaking water. She got caught in a storm with many of the other ships, and she collided with a frigate called the Devonshire, and her rigging was very majorly damaged, and she had to go back to port for 3 weeks or 2 or 3 weeks for repairs. But she served in the Crimean War. She was under the moniker of Transport 109 under the Crimean War. She was one of the few ships to escape the great storm that struck the Crimean War arena in 1854. And spent about 15 months just basically taking troops backward and forwards, bringing the invalids back and carrying stores around.
That's interesting. So there must have been a sudden demand for shipping to move troops and, as you say, to bring invalids around. And I suppose I don't know much about the process of how that worked. The flag went up, and were ships commandeered? Were they purchased? Were they rented? Do you know how that worked?
Well, I think it's a very canny Duncan Dunbar, because he paid quite a lot of money over the odds for the ship, but he already had a commission with the British government to provide Edwin Fox to that war arena. So he knew what he was doing. He was a pretty astute businessman there.
That sounds very sensible. So an interesting career there. Have you managed to find any accounts of people sailing on her during that period?
We have. We found quite a number of the troops and the leaders of the troops. We've also found a couple of instances of Crimean War veterans who were court-martialed and brought back on the ship as well. And what we're doing is we're researching into each of those people to try and find out what happened to them and where they went and what happened in their later careers.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And is a lot of that material in the National Archives in London? Is it spread all over the place?
It's a lot of it's on our favourite sites, Ancestry, but also a lot of it's in the British newspapers. A surprising amount is in the British newspapers. You have to just go trawling through them line by line to find out what's happening with the ship.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff. So those are two resources which are online and they're accessible to anyone all over the world,
which is brilliant. Yes, yeah. So after that, obviously spent a lot of time shipping cargo backwards and forwards. And then I guess in 1857, her most inglorious part of her career occurred when she was rented to transport indentured workers. So they were better known as coolies from Hong Kong to Cuba to work in the sugar plantations there. So that was to fill the backlog of, obviously, they were abolishing slavery at the time and the workers weren't forthcoming. So it's fair to say not all of the people who joined would have wanted to join. They were very poorly treated. And in fact, the Edwin Fox was one example put forward in the British Parliament under a paper submitted by Earl Carnarvon, who was vehemently against that industry. And he gave the example of the high mortality rate on the ships of, in the Edwin Fox's example, 309 people were taken, but 40 actually died on the way. And that kind of death rate was common amongst those kind of ships, which is absolutely appalling.
Hmm. And those are Chinese going to Cuba, were they?
Yes. Chinese labourers. And as I say, two terrible aspects. A lot of them didn't want to go, and it was very difficult for them to get back because not many ship owners wanted to bring them back to China because there wasn't an awful lot of, I suppose, profit in it. Although the Edwin Fox did bring one lot of people back in 1871, I think, through to India, of all places. So, yes, not a very proud part of her history.
No. But I understand she was also involved in taking convicts to Australia.
Yes, so we had one voyage from London to Fremantle, where she took approximately 280 convicts. The pensioner guards and their families went. So it's one of the only voyages we've found where there was no deaths on the voyage, which is quite remarkable. And there were some pretty interesting characters in there. There was two of the members of the first great train robbery, which occurred, so I'm not sure, probably well before your time, but in the 1970s, there's a film made about that with Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland. So I think in today's money, it's about $1.4 million worth of gold that they managed to steal and run away with. So they were part of that gang.
And they were caught and then sent to Fremantle?
Yes, sent to Fremantle for a long period of time. One of them rehabilitated, but the other one was just, he was a bit of a lost cause, to be honest.
That's interesting. I was recently at the Shipwrecks Museum of Western Australia in Fremantle, which was built by convicts. So I wonder if they had a hand in that, in the construction of that building.
They may well have done. Who knows?
Are the records good for researching into convicts and convict ships?
They are. They're very good. And we're hooked into a couple of organisations in Western Australia. So there's a group who are looking at convicts across all of the ships. And then there's another group who do a lot of research on the pensioner guards. So we're kind of exchanging information as to who was on the ship and what they did and what happened to them in later life.
So it's probably quite remarkable that the Edwin Fox survives as a convict ship, as a documented convict ship. Are there any others?
No, so this is the only wooden convict ship that remains. It's kind of one of a lot of instances. We think it's the only wooden ship from the Crimean War that served as a transport ship. And we also believe it's the only wooden ship left from Duncan Dunbar's fleet and the only wooden immigration ship left, which is where she headed for later in her life in the 1873 period.
That's interesting. So just go back to the indentured workers and the... Was the indentured workers voyage before the trip to Australia?
Yes, it was. I've got those a little bit out of sync. So the convict voyage was 1856 and then it was followed by the coolies going in 1857.
Interesting. But then starts having a career where people are travelling on board or who've actually elected to do so, which is a significant difference to the previous voyages.
Yes. So she played a stint in the Indian conflicts. So again, she was transporting British troops backward and forwards.
So that's the Indian Mutiny in
1865. So it's a little bit beyond the Indian Mutiny. It's just when the British colonialism was trying to force their power onto the Indian people. So I don't think it's actually a recognised conflict period, although perhaps some of your listeners and readers can help with that as well. But as well as the soldiers, she also carried a huge amount of alcohol as well. And she earned a nickname at one point of the booze barge because she carried so much alcohol, pale ale and whiskey and rums backward and forward between the continents.
From the UK to India?
Yes, and vice versa, yeah. And in fact, on one of the trips, when she was heading for Sri Lanka, the captain ran her aground and they had to jettison a vast amount of alcohol to refloat the ship. So no doubt he wasn't very popular at all.
That's interesting. The amount of alcohol being taken to India, was that for? Do we know if that was for consumption by British people who were living and working there, or whether they were selling it to the locals as well?
No, I would say it was the vast majority was for the British people living, working, and in the armed forces there.
Amazing.
Yes.
Amazing. And do we know if the alcohol, did it come from the southeast? Did it come from London or different ports in the UK?
I think it all came from the southeast, from the London area. But again, I can't be 100% that. I know that the London docks was a huge area for alcohol warehouses, so it's probably all stored there.
A faint kind of fragment in my mind is telling me that the history of India Pale Ale has something to do with alcohol in India in this period, IPA. But do you know anything about that? I know nothing about it.
Other than the fact the ship was used for transporting it backwards and forwards, no, not as a huge beer drinker, I can't help you on that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I bet some of our listeners are. So please, guys and girls, please get in touch and tell me what I think I'm supposed to know about Indian Pale Ale being transported to India, or clearly aboard the Edwin Fox. Fascinating stuff.
Yes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A really extraordinary period. Settlers getting on board and then travelling to Australia and New Zealand. Tell us about this period.
Yes, so she made 4 voyages under the Vogels immigration scheme, bringing immigrants from England through to the various ports in New Zealand. She did a voyage in 1873, 75, 78 and 80, and we think approximately 800 migrants were on board, although it is a little bit tricky because the passenger list didn't generally capture everybody. They just quite often just had heads of family. And we're finding a lot of people that would have travelled but were never registered in, as travelling on board, which is quite strange when you start looking at the families. The 1873 voyage was probably her most dangerous passage. She got caught in a storm. She was almost demasted, rescued by a steamer called the Compercius, something like that, a Captain Hudson, who was lauded at the time for being a hero, for basically getting a rope onto the ship and dragging her into the port of Brest, where she was repaired. She spent about 3 weeks there being repaired. Quite a number of the passengers, about 23 passengers, refused to get back on board. They had to replace the surgeon on board because, unfortunately, he'd been killed during the storm, as had a able seaman. Lots of injuries, you know, broken legs, chopped off fingers, all sorts of things between the crew and the passengers. And they're
remarkably common on ships, people losing their fingers. And if you've ever been on a ship, you understand why. It's those hatches and anything else that traps you. God, how awful.
Yes, the fast roads.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. So that the kind of interesting footnote to that is the replacement surgeon they sent over after being carried across from his hotel to the passengers by the agents on two occasions due to alcohol. It was deemed he wasn't suitable to join the ship as a replacement, and they ended up sending him back to London and found a third surgeon. So they did finally get somebody. So yes, they had quite an interesting voyage at that. But they all kind of made it. And throughout the voyages, we have a number of obviously deaths because of the conditions on board, but a remarkable number of births. And also quite a number of Edwin Foxes and Edwina Foxes named after the fact they were born on the ship as well that we're finding. So
that's wonderful. I think the giving birth on ships is interesting because there's a time issue, isn't there? People know, they tend to know they're pregnant and they tend to not go on board ship for 9 months, which means they definitely know that they're going to give birth on the vessel.
Yes.
And they've chosen to do it. I think that's absolutely fascinating. I should like some more research into that. In terms of the people going out to New Zealand, you're calling us from New Zealand now. Where did the settlers arrive? What was the traditional route to get into New Zealand?
So there's two, for the Edwin Fox, there's two ports of entry. There was Dunedin, which is in the bottom of the South Island, and their port there is Littleton. And then a number of the settlers would take smaller steamers and travel up the South Island and settle into the Nelson Marlborough area, which is where the museum is. And then the other area the ship would go to is Wellington, which is the capital city on the North Island. And they would start their lives there and again work their way up the country.
Mm. And which port were they leaving from in the UK?
Just from the London ports down there and then through the Downs and then across.
Do we know how long the voyage took?
It took between 3 and 4 months, except for the first voyage when they had the storm. So yes, between 3 and 4 months was the average, depending on weather conditions and where they stopped off en route to stock up.
So the people giving birth are a minimum of 5 months pregnant when they get on board?
Yeah, you thought you'd notice that, wouldn't you, to be honest?
Well, I mean, what were the? It's interesting, isn't it? What were the conditions like on board? Do we know?
In the later ships, the Edwin Fox kind of era, they were relatively good compared to the earlier ships. But we have an exhibit in our museum which replicates the steerage apartments, as you want to call them, bunks, and they're basically a lot shorter than you or I would be these days, and probably maybe a metre and a half wide, and they were for up to 3 people in each tier, and there was 2 tiers for them. So 6 people in a tier of bunks, you know, 1 bucket of water kind of a week to bathe in, and the food was also pretty appalling as well. So it just shows the conditions they left. They were willing to leave to spend months on board, you know, with all the conditions, the uncertainty of getting there, and the pregnancies, and what they were looking forward to when they got to New Zealand eventually.
Mm, fascinating stuff. It makes me really think that it was quite accepted behaviour. It was quite run of the mill that you would be prepared to give birth on a cold, windswept wooden sailing ship halfway around the world, which, you know, it also says a lot about society and their kind of preparation and understanding for coping with life at sea, which I think we've lost now. I mean, no one would go on a cruise now to give birth, would they?
Not knowingly, no. But I mean, they always had a surgeon on board, and the passengers, the female passengers, a couple of those were picked to be a matron and nurse. So they did have as much care as they could be provided. But yes, it's a hard choice to make.
Actually, I wonder if that's this is all kind of come out of the blue. I've been inspired by this. But maybe that's the reason they went on board the ship, or one of the reasons, because they knew there'd be a surgeon, they knew there'd be nursemaids, there would be help.
Yes, could well be. Conditions were probably better than in their hometowns.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And then, so what about the later bits of her career? What does she get up to?
So around the 82 period, she was back in London. So she did a few more voyages carrying cargo around. But then basically she was obsolete. And she was laid up in London for two and a half, three years, not with anything to do, basically. And then she was saved by the need in New Zealand for freezer hulks for the burgeoning sheep freezing industry and sheep export industry. So she was commissioned for that in 1885.
That's interesting as well, because that could only happen after people had invented freezers, which happened
Absolutely.
About the same period. And there was, I forget the name of the first... There was the first refrigerated cargo that went from New Zealand back to the UK and kind of changed everything in shipping. But she obviously, it obviously then advanced and then had frozen meat. Again,
yes,
something I don't know anything about.
Other than it tastes nice. So she in 1885, again, ended up in dry dock. Chopped out quite a few of the deck plants. They put in metal plates. They put in the Bell Coleman refrigeration equipment, 500 tons worth of coal, and basically she sailed across to Lyttelton. And that was her last voyage under her own sail. And then she spent the next few years, when she got to Lyttelton, being towed around various ports where the freezer industry was active. And she could hold up to about 14,000 carcasses at one point, which is quite an amount for a ship of that size. And then in 1897, I think it was, she was towed up to Picton, which was her last open sea voyage. By this time, her masts had gone. You know, she had quite an ugly looking wheelhouse on top with all the equipment in. And she ended up at the Picton freezing works, where she was there until about 1900, which was when she then got too small for that. And they built an onshore freezer works. And basically at that point, they decommissioned her as a freezing unit, cut a huge hole in the side of the ship, and she was used for the next 50 years as a coal hulk.
And then didn't rot, didn't fall apart? This is the miracle moment. This is when the ships like her disappear, but she managed to not die.
She managed to not die. She got worse and worse, obviously. They did start off with using her as accommodation for the freezer works. But by 1903, she was condemned for accommodation. And basically, 1905-ish, she was just abandoned. 1955, abandoned by the freezing works and just left there to rot.
Yeah, but has somehow been saved. So tell us, who decided to save her? How did that work?
Well, this was one of the minor miracles of, in 1964, a group of people, the New Zealand Heritage Trust, decided that they wanted to save her. At this point, she was still just a derelict at the side of the freezing works, and they argued for a number of years with the council to try and tow her away from there and put her somewhere safe. It took until 1967 before that was agreed. There's a lot of discussions about yes, you can, no, you can't. There's discussions about taking the ship out and the Royal Navy using it as target practice to sink it. Thankfully, they didn't.
They're always up to that, the Navy. You have to keep an eye on them.
They're always up to that.
In that period, yeah, they were trying to smashing up maritime heritage left, right, and centre.
Anything they could do. So in 1967, the ship was actually moved to a local bay called Shakespeare Bay, which was very shallow water. And they tied the ship to the trees by the beach foreshore. And the planning for that wasn't particularly well thought out, because as soon as the tide went out, the ship fell on its side, pulled out the trees, and just laid there for the next 20 years, basically, with the tides coming in and out and causing all sorts of havoc with the ship.
Mm. Yeah, but she's going into an interesting stage now. What's the current situation?
Well, she's in dry dock. She's nice and safe and sound now in dry dock. We have a wonderful museum with lots of artifacts for the ship, and we're now moving into the next phase of her life. So she's 170 years old now, and in the area around where the ship is dry docked, it's undergoing huge renovations for new ferries that are arriving in a couple of years. So there's a really close partnership between the museum and the project team who are doing that work to make sure she's not damaged during that process, because she's now a Category 1 heritage listed ship, and they're making every effort they can to make sure she's not damaged. So the monitoring dust, they've got the vibration monitors, because they're going to be doing some pile driving for new docks, and they're going to shrink wrap the whole dry dock area to protect her from dust, to make sure she doesn't get damaged in that way.
Well, I'd like to see that. It sounds like an excuse for me to come to New Zealand. Well, I have to say, Heather, it's definitely one of the most interesting ship histories I've come across for years. I think it's brilliant, and I wish you all the best with your project. Please tell our listeners how they could find out more about the ship. Do you have a website or social media or something?
We have an Edwin Fox museum site, and we have lots of our artifacts and histories online, part of the New Zealand Museums site. And we have just become a content partner with Digital New Zealand, which is a New Zealand government initiative, which has about 200 content partners, 34 million or so records and counting. And we're building stories on there and pulling information from our collection and from everyone else's collection around the world as well. So those are three really good places to find more information. And everyone is always welcome to come through and look in the museum itself.
Yes, well, I want to come and see when it's all shrink-wrapped. That sounds cool. That really, really appeals to me, that kind of mad engineering project to save maritime heritage. Listen, I've really enjoyed talking to you. What a wonderful project, and I wish you all the best.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you all so much for listening. I hope I can hear you all now busily booking your flights and ferries to New Zealand to support the brilliant Edwin Fox. No doubt you'll be needing entertainment on your long journeys to New Zealand, so let me encourage you to go to our YouTube channel. Yes, that must be your first stop, to see a whole library of amazing videos presenting the maritime historical world in an entirely new way. We've recently posted a couple of brilliant animated maps illuminating the maritime history of Australia, but there's much, much more. Who could ever forget our use of artificial intelligence and digital artistry to bring ships' figureheads to life? Please remember that this podcast is brought to you from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. Be sure to check out the Lloyd's Register Foundation's latest project, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera technology. To find it, just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. That's Maritime Innovation in Miniature. And the Society for Nautical Research, you can find them at snr.org.uk, where you can join up. It's a great way of not only meeting people who share your interest in maritime history, but also of learning about the maritime past from the very best in the business. That's all for now. Keep listening, but above all, keep spreading the word. Tell everyone you know about the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Tell them at the yacht club. Tell them at the library. Tell them at the museum. Tell them at the supermarket. Anything you can do will help us on our mission to spread the gospel of maritime history around the world. See you soon. We'll be right back.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.